From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Afghan election crisis. The US warns rival presidential candidates that any attempt at a power grab could cost the country US support.
The desire of the Afghan population for the rule of law, for laws that apply to powerful people as well as weak people, for a say in their collective destiny, could hardly have been more deafening.
Also today, the child sex abuse scandal shaking Britain's political establishment continues, and why the most grueling competition on earth, the Tour de France, may need to rethink its title.
I think it is trying to become a Europe-wide event, and actually I wouldn't rule out that it potentially might go to another part of the continent in years to come.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Israel says it's ready to step up its military assault on the Gaza Strip unless Hamas stops firing rockets into Israeli territory. Israeli officials say more than 130 rockets have been fired from Gaza since Monday. The Palestinians claim a dozen people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes, violence that has intensified since the murder of three Israeli teenagers and one Palestinian teenager in separate incidents last week. The White House is urging calm, but Middle East analyst Shibli Telhami of the University of Maryland says the Obama administration has few cards to play.
I don't really see the U.S. as having a particularly strong hand in stopping the Israelis from doing something the Israelis want to do in Gaza.
President Obama is requesting more than $3.5 billion in emergency funding to deal with a massive influx of child migrants trying to enter the United States across its southern borders. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Kate Fisher reports.
The White House says the money will be used to increase legal and border staff for drone surveillance and medical services. Spokesman Josh Earnest says the president is asking Congress for emergency funds in order to respond to a humanitarian situation.
We hope that Congress will act quickly on this emergency request for additional funding so that we can use these resources to address the problem.
The president's due to go to Texas on Wednesday. He's faced criticism that he won't be visiting the border during his trip. Kate Fisher, Washington.
The White House says election results in Afghanistan are neither final nor authoritative, and it's urging the country's rival presidential candidates to give the Afghan Election Commission a chance to investigate allegations of fraud. Former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah is claiming victory in the elections, despite preliminary results showing the presidency was won by his rival Ashraf Ghani. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says President Obama wants Afghanistan's rival politicians to cool their increasingly heated rhetoric.
We expect a thorough review of all reasonable allegations of fraud, and that there is no justification for resorting to violent or extra-constitutional measures.
The Vatican Bank has announced a sharp fall in profits, ascribing the decline to suspicious accounts being closed. The often scandal-hit bank has been forced to reform to meet international transparency standards. From FSN's brand new bureau in Rome, Elena Casas reports.
Cleaning up the Vatican Bank was an early priority for Pope Francis, who swept away the old guard of Italian staff and replaced them with a new team under German financier Ernst von Freiburg. The cost of reform has caused its profits to plummet by 83 million euros in a year. Elena Casas, Rome.
And from a growing band of bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Two British men have pleaded guilty to terrorism charges after admitting they travelled to Syria to join rebel fighters battling the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. 22-year-olds Naheen Ahmed and Yusuf Sawar were arrested in January when they returned to Britain after 8 months in Syria. They were accused of joining the al-Nusra Front and wrote letters to their parents in which they expressed the hope that they would die as martyrs. The Chief Constable of West Midlands Police, Marcus Beale, says the convictions show Westerners recruited by jihadist groups can be brought to justice.
I think it demonstrates the quality of investigation that's been done by my staff over at the West Midlands Counterterrorism Unit to put together a compelling case that these two had been with a group aligned to al-Nusra in Syria and in the fighting zone.
Russia's foreign ministry is accusing the United States of kidnapping a Russian citizen after 30-year-old Roman Selesnyov was arrested by American Secret Service agents in the Maldives on Saturday. From FSN's Moscow Bureau, Natalie Powell reports.
Russia says it wasn't informed about Mr. Selesnyov's case, nor was it told about his detention. After his arrest, the 30-year-old Russian was taken from the Maldives via private jet to Guam Island. Russia's foreign ministry is outraged that the Maldives ignored international legislation norms and allowed another country's special services to take the man out of the country, calling it an unfriendly move by the US against Russia. Mr. Selesnyov is accused of hacking a US retail computer system in order to steal thousands of credit card numbers. He was indicted in Washington state in 2011 on charges of bank fraud and causing damage to a protected computer. Natalie Powell, Moscow.
And that is the latest feature story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Serious allegations of fraud have been raised, but they have yet to be adequately investigated. So we reiterate that the preliminary results that were announced yesterday are neither final nor authoritative, and may not even predict the final outcome, which could still change based on the findings of Afghan's electoral bodies.
The White House reiterating John Kerry's warning to Afghanistan's presidential candidates not to form a parallel government as the country's election mess continues. Preliminary results show Ashraf Ghani leading his rival Abdullah Abdullah, who says the vote was rife with fraud. The Afghan Election Commission is delaying announcing a winner while those accusations are investigated. The US Secretary of State said any attempt to take power illegally following the vote would cost Afghanistan US support. I spoke to Sarah Chase, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and began by asking if she was surprised by the election crisis.
I'm not surprised in the least, unfortunately. The 2009 presidential election was marred by just egregious examples of fraud, ballot box stuffing, abuse of government office for partisan purposes. And in the intervening period, very little was done to try to safeguard against similar abuses this time around. If anything, those safeguards were dismantled very deliberately by President Karzai, and the international community didn't do much to prevent that dismantling.
What then is at stake in terms of the United States' relationship with Afghanistan, depending on the outcome of this result? Because John Kerry has already warned against a power grab, but we're hearing talk of a parallel government.
The focus of the United States in the last several years has been a transition, a passing off of authority and autonomy to Afghan institutions. Unfortunately, not as much focus was placed on whether those institutions were solid enough, were representative enough, included enough checks and balances for them to be seen as legitimate by the vast majority of the Afghan people. Some who don't see them as legitimate have taken up arms, and others who don't see them as legitimate haven't. And I would say the first round of voting, which saw such an enthusiastic turnout on the part of the Afghan people, really was a sign both of their desire for democratic governance and their repudiation of President Karzai, since his chosen candidate came in third. But a demand for democratic governance doesn't equal the reality of democratic governance. And so that gap is a very important gap that I think has been ignored by American decision makers. So U.S. decision makers saw the first round of voting with this huge sigh of relief that, Afghans voted. And just didn't take the next step to see that the systemic weaknesses in Afghan governance are so deep that the whole thing could collapse. And so, of course, what the United States was hoping for was a peaceful transition to a new leadership, but B, stability. and it's likely that they'll get neither. Now, whether that will change anything fundamental in U.S. policy toward Afghanistan in the coming months and years is not clear. And I think in this regard, Iraq is a quite interesting analogy, where Iraq is imploding, and you're not seeing a gigantic reaction on the part of the United States government.
John Kerry is actually due to touch down in Afghanistan later this week. What do you think his approach might be, or should be?
I think that his approach should be to uphold the basic rule of law. I think that Afghanistan has suffered over the last decade not so much from Western imposition of Western cultural norms, but even worse, Western imposition of what Westerners think are Afghan cultural norms. And that has tended to pie-cutting or sort of pie-dividing negotiated settlements. It has tended to reinforcing warlord tendencies, whereas the desire of the Afghan population for the rule of law, for laws that apply to powerful people as well as weak people, for a say in their collective destiny, could hardly have been more deafening over the past decade. And yet somehow we're not hearing that. And we've had a tendency to focus too exclusively on the political elites, the levers of power that we've often been reinforcing. So I think it would be critical for Secretary Kerry not to jettison fundamental standards of the rule of law.
Sarah Chase, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This is FSN Reports. The top civil servant at Britain's Home Office has admitted that over 100 files containing allegations of child sex abuse at Westminster have probably been destroyed. Mark Sedwill was questioned by MPs amid allegations that leading British politicians and public figures were at the centre of a paedophile ring in the 1980s. Two major inquiries into the claims are now being set in motion. Tim Loughton is a former children's minister in Britain's governing Conservative Party, and he was asked if the inquiry unveiled yesterday is going far enough.
No, I think the news from Theresa yesterday is very welcome indeed, and a lot happened in just the last few days. And Theresa May, almost uniquely it seems, amongst cabinet ministers, has appreciated the real gravity of this constant drip-drip of revelations to do with historic child sex abuse. So this is a very good start. The important thing is that the inquiry will be flexible. It will be led by a group of experts who've got real authority and respect in this area, and the inquiry needs to go wherever it needs to go.
Mark Sedwill, meanwhile, Tim, up before senior MPs later, under pressure over those lost files. What's he likely to say?
Well, again, that's going to come out this morning, and further work is going to be done with the help of Peter Wanless over the next couple of months. And I think this really brought it to a head. When this whole ghastly saga of child sex abuse starts to knock on the door of Westminster, and various names, whether they're implicated or not, start to be mentioned, and then dossiers going back to the 1980s go missing, and then 114 files, the contents of which we don't know, go missing. Clearly, that has raised a whole raft of new questions, and answers need to be found urgently. And by appointing Peter Wanless to help with that inquiry, somebody who has a lot of knowledge with child protection, kind of the NSPCC, but who also worked in government in the civil service before, so knows which doors to open and how the whole operation works, I think is a good way of trying to get to the bottom of it and starting to answer many of these questions that have been cropping up.
You are a former children's minister. Do you think there'll be plenty of people, perhaps, who would want to know why you and perhaps your colleagues haven't used parliamentary privilege to actually name and shame suspected paedophiles in the Commons? How much did you know?
Well, when I was children's minister, almost 2 years ago now, it was just before the Savile revelations came out, and that was the absolute key to unlocking this tsunami of historic child abuse allegations now coming forward. There were various inquiries and concerns going around at the time, but I have to say what we were doing was spending a lot of time, and I launched the Child Sex Child Sexual Exploitation Action Plan back in 2011, which is a direct result of which many more offenders have been brought to book. We've made it easier for victims to come forward, and many of those perpetrators, modern-day perpetrators, are now in jail. So this government has actually done more than any other government in overhauling the way we do child protection. And the irony is that these historic child abuse allegations coming out now risk undermining all the work that has been done and any confidence the public has in child protection. So I wanted to, as soon as Savile came out, it was absolutely crucial that we got to the heart of what had been happening over the last few decades and put all these historical child abuse allegations into context. And that's why I've been calling for over 18 months now for the sort of inquiry that Theresa May has announced yesterday.
Former British Government Children's Minister Tim Loughton talking there to Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. Tour de France executives say they're thrilled with the way the race got started in Britain. The gruelling 2,200-mile, three-week-long marathon is widely viewed as the toughest competition in sport. Reporter John Cushing of LBC Radio says the tour may make a return to Britain soon.
Yeah, it was a great day, actually, Andre, and I think that everybody kind of knew it would be, and, you know, more than a million people on the streets of London alone. Obviously, started off in Cambridge in the sunshine and ended on the Mall in a bit of rain, but it didn't dampen the atmosphere at all. I think what went really well is the riders really enjoyed it as well. If you talk to most of them, they're kind of like, wow, this is it, this is incredible, you know, reaction in the UK. And then, you know, as you say, Christian Prudhomme said, you know, that they want to do it again. And actually, the big thing is, it's a bit like the Olympics, it's a bit like the World Cup, where you can bid to hold stages. So the UK has held it in 1974, back in Plymouth, which was a bit of a disaster. But it got better in 94, when it was on the south coast. And then London's held it in 2007, when they had the big Grand Depart, in 7 years ago, and obviously then stage three yesterday. So could it come back to the UK for a fifth time? Well, I've been talking to the Mayor of London's Chief of Staff, Ed Lister, who told me this.
We're certainly going to put another pitch in for again, probably about 2018 will be the next opportunity, and we'd like to get back, because for us, I mean, the raw economics of this is worth about £100 million to the UK economy in tourism.
Do we know where it's going to go next year?
Well, you know, as I say, the tour kind of is used on a yearly basis, so you can bid to stage each bit. And last year it was in Belgium, for example, it started there. So it's always worth keeping an eye on the Tour de France, despite the title. I think it is trying to become a Europe-wide event. And actually, I wouldn't rule out that it potentially might go to another part of the continent in years to come. It is the biggest annual sporting event in the world that they put on. And obviously Britain is getting into it more and more. More people are cycling, more people want to see it. So let's see how it kind of pans out. But hopefully it will come back to London, or certainly the UK, as Ed said there, in a few years' time. But obviously just today, stage four is underway. They're back across the channel. They were supposed to go on the Eurostar yesterday, but with all the problems there, they jumped on a ferry. And the English tour is over, I suppose you could say. So it's stage four from La Touquet to Lille Metropole today. It's another sprinter's kind of paradise. It's 163 kilometres. So Marcel Kittel, who won the first stage in Yorkshire and then again in London, is going to be one of the big favourites, I would say, to win stage four, which sees the Tour de France back in France.
Now, you were at the course end yesterday, and I caught it just when it came out of Epping Forest, and it was amazing how many people turned out and the excitement, and not many complaints about how many roads it closed on what would have been one of the busiest days of the week.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we've kind of got used to it with the Olympics a couple of years ago. You know, with all this kind of, it's going to be chaos. Actually, if people plan, then they have an idea about what's going to happen and they change their plans. I actually don't think many people did much work yesterday, to be brutally honest, Andre. I think London London kind of ground to a halt, certainly mid-afternoon. When I was down on the Mall, there was a mixture of lots of kids, mums and dads, grands and granddads, absolutely, but a lot of men in suits as well, not just in Lycra on their bikes, but in suits and office workers. And, you know, you could tell people had just kind of popped out of the office for a couple of hours. So actually, you know, I talked to Ed Lister about it at the mayor's office and said, look, not much work has been done. He said, no, but the benefits it brings, the financial benefits it brings on top of that, and then tourism in the future, is well worth a day of disruption.
LBC's John Cushing. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, we put the focus on Turkey, a country that lies at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, giving it enormous geopolitical importance under any circumstances. And with the conflicts in neighbouring Iraq and Syria continuing to grab world headlines, Turkey is never far from the conversation. The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, perhaps best known in the US for his attempt to ban Twitter earlier this year, says he will run in the country's first directly elected presidential contest this summer. After a controversial decade as Turkey's prime minister, he's vowed to transform the presidency into a more active institution, one that breaks the grips of the country's aging elites and one that may raise further questions about Turkey's historic commitment to secularism. The Financial Times' Ben Hall spoke to the paper's Istanbul correspondent Daniel Dombey and its international affairs columnist David Gardner, who's based in Beirut. And he started by asking Daniel Dombey if there really is a risk of Turkey moving down a more authoritarian path.
In particular, over the last 12 months, we've seen a series of events. Police put down to demonstrations, the movement of at least 8,000 police and thousands of judges and prosecutors to derail corruption inquiries, Twitter banned by the Prime Minister's personal decision. So real signs that people elsewhere in the world have seen as increasing authoritarianism and throwing the rule of law into doubt. So if one reason why people are concerned is what they see as a pre-existing trend, the other issue is just the risk that with a presidency actually incarnated in the same man himself, over and above the actual law that Turkey has, there will be really almost no checks and balances left in Turkish life.
What's the counter-argument?
Well, the counter-argument is that the presidency is a much less powerful job than the premiership. Presidents have been largely ceremonial in Turkish history. Even when the president has been a former coup leader, the former coup leader who wrote the constitution for his own use, he didn't really use the presidency in a very commandeering way. Previous powerful prime ministers have gone to the presidential mansion in Çankaya in Ankara and found the experience a frustrating one because they neither have their hands on the levers of government nor control of the party, because under the Turkish constitution, the president can't be a partisan figure, so they don't control the party list that gives immense powers of patronage. Mr. Erdogan has tried to change the constitution, indeed get a new constitution that would give him greater presidential powers, but he's failed. And if the AKP vote doesn't increase, and there are reasons to believe that it won't increase beyond the 50% or so that it logged in 2011, it may be still harder for him to get those constitutional changes.
David, which of these scenarios do you think is more plausible?
Well, I don't doubt that Erdogan is going to win. But if it goes to a second round, he's going to need Kurdish votes to get over that bar. That means that sometime between now and then, he will have had to have made significant gestures towards the Kurdish clamour for more rights to run their own affairs at a time when it looks likely that just over the border in northern Iraq, the Kurdish regional government is preparing, after enlarging its territory, declare independence. And just a little bit west from there, and this has been true for a year, that the Kurds of northeast Syria, at least in three provinces, run their own affairs. So this is going to be quite tricky for him, because the timing and weight of such gestures needs to be carefully calibrated. I mean, he doesn't want to stampede voters into the arms of radical nationalist Turks, and there are a lot of them about. And At the same time, he may not know how far exactly to go with the Kurds. There's no roadmap for this peace initiative that he's launched, the most far-reaching in the history of the Turkish Republic, because there's no process. The whole thing is in the heads of two somewhat messianic figures, that is to say, Erdogan himself and Abdullah Öcalan, the PKK leader. So there are a number of uncertainties here, but I entirely agree with Dan. The point is that Erdogan will win the presidential election, but the AKP, his party, still has to win next year's general election. The moment that Erdogan leaves the prime minister's office and the party leadership, the AK party will be searching for a vote winner of equal prowess to succeed him. And I don't really see how he can keep control, keep his hands on the levers of government and party in the same way that he has now, however much he talks up the latent powers in the existing presidential system. Because ultimately, his MPs and party cadres are going to have to look out for themselves after he ascends the throne, as it were.
Dan, Mr. Erdogan has been blessed with a fairly ineffectual and bitterly divided political opposition, particularly in Parliament. Anyway, is there any sign of that changing?
Well, the question of the opposition is an interesting one. Traditionally, it's been fragmented. It's certainly been ineffective. On the one hand, we actually have a change here. We have a joint candidate for the two biggest opposition parties, the Republican People's Party, the traditional secularists, and the Nationalist Movement Party, the Nationalists. They've chosen a figure who marks a bit of a break. His name is Ekmeleddin İnsanoğlu, and he's a former head of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. So he's a break with the previous secularist figures that they've trotted out. Nevertheless, this is an incredibly low-profile man, and he's mounting an incredibly low-profile campaign. It's barely visible compared to the wall-to-wall coverage of Mr. Erdogan. In fact, he's even forsworn holding mass rallies. So it's unclear how much mileage he's going to be making, particularly when there's an awful lot of pro-government press. In addition, it's not clear how much he's going to appeal to Turkey's Alevis, that's the non-Sunni religious minority in Turkey, who feel, I think, a little bit of concern about having a figure with his Islamic credentials running. There is another candidate, the third candidate, who is the Kurdish candidate, Selahattin Demirtas, and he has a base of about 6.5%. He's really running to be the kingmaker. He's really running to get their second round. And given these concerns among some of the traditional secularist base, particularly the Alevis, he's really running to boost his appeal and get perhaps 10% to try and enshrine that role as a kingmaker. So in some senses, this may be a year in which the opposition, at least the Kurdish opposition, has greater weight than before. We're seeing two experiments here, but neither really put to date the election of Mr. Erdogan in doubt.
That's Daniel Dombey, the Istanbul correspondent for the Financial Times, talking with the paper's international affairs columnist, David Gardner. The conversation was moderated by the FT's Ben Hall, and you can read all the paper's coverage of the Turkish presidential campaign in the newspaper itself, of course, and on its website at ft.com. You'll also find more of that conversation on the website as well. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Wednesday, we return to the unrest in the Middle East as Israel steps up its offensive against Hamas militants. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks on the Bulletin Desk. Everyone with FSN everywhere. Have a good evening. Goodbye.